Hello, and welcome to What We Brought Home, with your hosts, Mike Izzo and Pat McGinty. We invite military veterans to anonymously share their stories of war and service, specifically the stories that they hide from the world. The stories featured on this podcast often include sensitive topics like death and violence that might be triggering for some. At times, you might even hear us or our guests laugh at situations that are actually quite serious. Like other jobs that involve life or death situations, grim and ironic humor is often a way to cope. Listener discretion is advised. Also, at times, you may notice breaks in the audio. We take anonymity very seriously, and we edit stories to protect the identities of the storyteller and others involved. Finally, if what you hear in this episode reminds you of one of your own experiences and you want to share your story, let us know. If it's something from your time in service that you often think about but rarely talk about, you're not alone. We're here to listen with no judgment. All stories are shared anonymously. Go ahead and visit our website, whatwebrought home.com, to learn more. Hello, everyone. Again, to What We Brought Home. I am here with my co-host, Pat McGinty. Hey, Pat, how are you doing?
Hi, guys. Doing well.
We have our next guest. We are excited to talk to him. We have an Army veteran, a veteran of multiple conflicts, multiple deployments, and he's going to tell us all about it. So thank you for being here, and I'll turn the floor over to him.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Pat, for having me on today. This has been a really tremendous process, and helping me to think through my combat experiences, my pre-deployment experiences and the whole like, and really come into terms with a lot of things that up to this point I probably really haven't shared in a whole lot of detail. So thank you both for this opportunity, and I think it's important before I really start sharing my story to reiterate something that journalist and author Robert Kaplan wrote, and he said that hindsight is lazy because it reduces complexity to a counterfeit clarity. And I think it's important to state that up front because, our hindsight bias is part of our challenge as we process the various thoughts and emotions and other reactions to our experiences, and especially when those experiences include the death or injury of our fellow soldiers, or service members. And, there's other complexities to that we don't even necessarily think about at the time, and that the positive experiences are so closely connected with the negative experiences. And it just adds, layers and layers to those experiences. And so with that, I can just share with you a little bit of my background, why I joined the Army, because I was 29 years old when I started my Army career. Neither of my parents had served in the military, and though I had a couple uncles that served during the Vietnam War, I was not unusually close with them. And so joining the Army was just not something that I had ever really considered. In fact, my wife and I thought we were going to go be missionaries in Eastern Europe or someplace like that. But that all changed, in the summer of 2001, after her grandfather died of cancer. The family had always known that he served in the Army during World War II, but no one knew the full story until after he passed away, when they found a life insurance policy that he had from the Army. And he, numerous other Americans following the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, enlisted in the Army. But unlike many, he enlisted on December 8th, 1941. And so that had a profound impact on me, and I just began thinking, what would I do? Would I have the fortitude to drop out of college my senior year and go fight for my country like that? And, a few months later, that thought would resurface as Al-Qaeda used, civilian airplanes as missiles to attack the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And, while my story is not quite as dramatic, I didn't join the Army on September 12th. It was shortly after the new year that I signed an OCS contract and was on pays to go to Fort Benning to go to officer candidate school. And, you know, before even leaving, you know, the challenges started to bubble up. My wife gave birth to our oldest son 13 days before I left for Fort Benning. And so it was a huge challenge for our family in that my initial entry training would begin to disrupt, you know, just the normal patterns of life for our family. Over the course of the next, you know, 18 months, you know, attended all the relevant entry training for being an infantry officer before I PCS in preparation for their 2005 deployment to Iraq. You know, we went through our train up and in the days leading up to our deployment, my second son was born to my wife and I, and was literally supposed to leave 5 days later. But our battalion commander saw fit to give me an extra week. So I was able to stay home for 12 days after after his birth. So I'm really using up any currency I have with my wife pretty quick in my first 2 years in the Army. And, you know, that's all part of us going. It's not only just what we bring home, but it's what we take with us, you know, when we go on deployments that adds to the complexity of dealing with all this. And the emotions experienced by my wife and I could not have been more different, though. She was grappling with what in her mind was my imminent death and how she and our two young sons would cope with that loss, while I was excited to leave my growing family to finally go fight for my country. You know, it was a relatively uneventful first couple months in that deployment. We moved north, conducted combat operations for the next 9 months. Right away, we knew things were going to be different than the previous 3 months. The enemy were a little bit emboldened, but our company commander thought that we would be better served by conducting dismounted operations in the city, you know, to really keep the pressure on what at that point had started to become Al-Qaeda in Iraq. You know, rockets, mortars, small arms fire were the primary weapons of choice employed by AQI at the time. And so over the course of the next few months, we conducted a series of raids and cordon and search operations that allowed us to really keep things to a minimum in violence there. And we were busy and worn out, but, you know, the violence that was spiking around the country was not something that we were dealing with. Before the end of that deployment, we were already preparing to come back to Iraq before we were even really preparing to go home. And then when we did, you know, it was right back into an intense training cycle. The Sunni awakening of mid-2007, it had taken hold. And so violence was greatly reduced, you know, and the units that were before us had really fought hard to secure at least a foothold there. So by the time we got there, it was really just trying to maintain the stability and security. And though it was still dangerous, it was no longer the hotbed of violence that it had been just a few years prior. And so redeploying, I now had spent a full 3 years gone from my family, growing family, and would PCS where I would, you know, eventually take command of an infantry company in preparation to deploy to Afghanistan. And the timing of taking command when I did, for me professionally, was tremendous. I would get a full training cycle before deploying the company to combat, and it was a welcome distraction for me for the loss of twins when my wife miscarried just a few weeks prior to that. I poured myself into preparing for myself and soldiers for combat, and hardly gave the impacts of what was happening at home even a fleeting thought, and I, you know, justified it by the belief that my family wanted me to come home alive and the preparation was necessary. You know, we trained hard that fall and we knew it was going to be a violent deployment. I essentially left my family to mentally and emotionally prepare for another year-long deployment with little or no thought to how they were feeling. And so when we arrived, the terrain was restrictive and dangerous. The platoons were just taking a beating. It was hard living. I mean, it was mud huts and thatched roofs, and you know, everything was covered in dirt. Soldiers were covered in dirt. Equipment was covered in dirt. Food was covered in dirt. I mean, it was pretty squalid living. You know, in spite of the losses, the company continued to respond with resiliency and professionalism, just as you know, you would expect them to. But you know, the pace was still, you know, crushing for all of us. And you know, we continued to patrol from our strong points and would ultimately expand our footprint from village to village. And it was not uncommon for us to go from, you know, shooting Taliban in the fields to, you know, moving humanitarian assistance, you know, seconds later in the village. And so soldiers were up and down. I was up and down as far as the personal stress that everybody was under. And but as both of you guys know from your own experiences, you know, there are highs and lows throughout a deployment. And it ended up, you know, bringing our KIA as a company, you know, to right around 7, and then, you know, another 30 plus wounded for the company at that point. And so it really tested everybody's resolve, and the roller coaster for me continued. You know, I was accepted to a fellowship, and that meant that I was going to leave command. You know, that was a real, while it should have been an exciting thing because I was going to go get this great opportunity, it was really kind of devastating to leave at the time. I was going to go home and reunite with my family, who, you know, was struggling without me. In fact, you know, at the height of the fighting season, you know, after a previous, you know, miscarriage, my wife gave birth to our fourth son, and you know, I didn't go home, you know, because I didn't feel like I could. And you know, looking back, I think it was still the right decision, but I didn't have necessarily the best attitude about it, and certainly didn't going home. And so, you know, I left and waited for the battalion to return. And fortunately, you know, we had gotten things to such a good point with the villagers that we were able to sustain it through the rest of the deployment, and there was no further injury or loss of life in the company. And you know, it didn't change that solitary feeling of going home alone, leaving the guys there. So I certainly wanted to see that through. But you know, what I found was that re-entry was in a lot of ways just as traumatic as the loss of life in the combat experiences, you know, and just dealing with the violence in Afghanistan. And you know, I immediately missed the simplicity, because your priorities are pretty clear, you know, when you're deployed, and they tend to get a little bit muddled when you get back. But you know, I struggled with our losses, especially and one in particular, because as I said, you know, like when I deployed, I couldn't wait to get to Iraq, get to Afghanistan, and hadn't given really much thought to, you know, what was going on at home, you know, with my wife giving birth to our boys and then leaving 2 weeks later. And so this one team leader in particular had been a veteran of the Korngal Valley just a year prior. And he gave up 3 months of dwell time to deploy with us in March. And he was killed in April. So 5 weeks into our deployment, he was killed, and had the opportunity to have stayed home with his wife. And you know, one of the images that's like burned into my head is the day we left, you know, when he's saying goodbye to his wife, and the guy was just, I mean, the waterworks were on full blast. And I don't think I shed a tear, you know, once in the 3 times that I left. You know, I would shed tears from time to time, I think, but certainly not. I was not heartbroken over leaving. And, you know, like I said, when we started, I never gave a second thought to what me leaving was doing to my family. And so when I first came home, one of the biggest challenges I had was learning how to live for others. You know, I think we were all and would all be willing to die for, you know, our battle buddies. And we even say that, you know, about our families, but I don't know that I fully appreciated the opportunity to get to live for my family and live for my country. And there were days that, you know, as I was commuting, you know, thoughts would come up of, you know, just dealing with the tragedy of the loss. And it would be easier to just step out in front of that train as it's pulling into the station. And, you know, honestly, the only reason I didn't is I knew that it would make things worse for my wife and kids, because they would blame themselves. And so I really poured myself into meeting with a spiritual mentor, and he helped me just to acknowledge it, just acknowledge the hurt, acknowledge what I had done with my to my family, right, and how I dealt with it. But you know, that led to, you know, a connection with him that helped me to start to deal with things with my wife. And, you know, as I wrap up, you know, my story with you guys, I, you know, this process and thinking through it and preparing for today just helped me to realize that, you know, I've got to trust my wife and my friends more and be able to share, you know, some of these things with, you know, with them. And whether it's my soulmate, you know, or my swole mates, that I got to be willing to share with them, you know, and I've got to do a better job of staying connected with those I serve with.
First of all, thank you for sharing that story. I'm really impressed with the conclusions that you came to from all of those experiences that you lived. I think a couple of things that stood out to me, sort of like central themes, is, and these are things that I struggled with as well, is the pull between wanting to go and do what we're supposed to do versus the impact that we have on those at home is sometimes not realized by us.
I want to just try to illuminate this point for listeners who may not fully grasp the gravity of you leaving early, right? Like you were the company commander of this unit. You were assigned to them for like a year prior to deploying, or less than a year?
I had been in command for about 8 months when we left, and was in command in theater for 8 months before leaving. So I had 16 months with them at that point.
Yeah. So company commander, you're responsible for the whole unit. There's a ceremony, you're handed the flag that represents the unit, and, you know, and then you feel the weight of responsibility of every single human being and their families in that unit.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that is your job, is to take care of them and to train them and prepare them for war. Just like, you know, you said that, you know, you felt like the best thing you could do was focus on preparing them. So you get to know every single person in the unit. You know, you want to build morale. You want them to feel good about what they're doing. So you're connecting with them, you're getting to know them, getting to know their families. Then you kind of shepherd them overseas on this experience that every single one of them, they will remember for the rest of their lives. Some of them have been thinking about it for years. And now you're there, you guys are working together. You're kind of singularly focused on the mission there. You're taking loss. You've taken some losses. And so I'm imagining, you know, your vision of being in that job when you're overseas is like, okay, my job is to get everyone back home safely, return them to their families. And that's your mission. That's what you're focused on. And someone comes in and is like, okay, nope, you're done. You can see the finish line a few months ahead of you. And someone's like, no, we're going to pull you out of this early.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even just talking to my wife about it, sometimes I feel like if I share something with her about how I felt or didn't feel, at the time.
Right.
Like, would it be something that could hurt her worse than I already have? Or if you tell somebody from the unit that you were ready to go home, are they going to judge you for being excited to go home? And so you're right. There was that, you know, and I think that's a part of what makes dealing with it so, so complex, you know, is that those are good things, but they're also devastating things, you know, and that's how I would describe leaving early. I was devastated. And so, you know, dragging my rucksack and duffel bag, you know, across Ali Asalim and Kandahar airfield, you know, by myself, like, was just gut-wrenching because I had nobody to talk to about it. And when I got home, like, I didn't really deep down want to be there at the time. And so, you know, processing that and trying to work through those feelings, because I should have been excited to be home. I have a great family, you know, I have an awesome wife who loves me, and I got amazing kids, who needed me. And I just didn't see it as a, for what it was, and that it was a blessing, you know, and that, like, though the soldiers needed me, it is the Army, man, you know, it goes marching along. And so, yeah, I think you're right. It was incredibly disappointing. And again, you know, just adds to the complexity of dealing with the baggage, I guess, for better or worse.
Yeah, you sort of, I think you summarized up the entire experience with, it's devastating and it's good. Like, and trying to wrap your head around that is so difficult, right? It's just, and unless you've been through it, I don't know if you could understand that. Like, but I know exactly what you're saying when you say that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the best conversations I was able to have with my wife was probably about 3 years after I'd come back, and she knew that I was struggling. She didn't understand why, you know, and I hadn't given her any indication as to why. And she told me, you know, we were sitting on the front porch, and she told me that she had been just praying for me, you know, and trying to understand without me giving her any indication of what was bothering me, but that she felt like she just needed to know. And would I share with her what I was struggling with? And at the time, I was dealing with the loss of our team leader, and how he had given up that 3 months at home. He and his wife signed his declination paper. So they made that decision together. And the day we left was the last day they saw each other. And so it rocked me, not just as a person, but as I mean, like I said at the beginning, I thought I was going to go be a missionary, you know, before 9/11. And so, you know, not just my faith, but my wife and I's faith together, like it rocked it. It you know, it really made me question how God could be good allowing something like that to take place. And so, you know, I'm going to church every Sunday. I'm active at church. I'm active, you know, in my faith, my family, but behind that is this questioning of whether God is good, you know? And so that experience took something that was very positive in my life, and like tarnished it, you know? And so there was a lot of guilt and, you know, associated feelings with, you know, thinking that God didn't care. And, you know, I wasn't sure who I could share that with, you know? And so, like, fortunately, when I said that to my wife, she took it in a lot of ways as a relief, because I was honest with her. And so, you know, she just encouraged me that if God is real, like, he can withstand your scrutiny, you know, like, if he really is the creator of the universe, asking the question of him, you know, do you really care, is pretty mundane question, and I shouldn't feel as guilty about it as I did. But, you know, and so it was a huge turning point for us in our marriage, and allowing us to heal, not just me personally in that experience and that loss, but to allow us to heal together. For the 3 years in between, man, they were not pretty. I mean, I never beat my wife or my kids, not physically. But I was like a flash fire, man, you know? Like I could go from being calm, cool, and collected to yelling and chin quivering, you know, explosive anger in seconds. And so my family walked on eggshells, you know. My wife knew, she knew the extent of what I was dealing with over there. She didn't have to deal with the violence itself and how it just overwhelms all five senses, right? Like she didn't understand that aspect of it, but she understood the impacts later and how, especially on the families. So she shared in more of it than I gave her credit for. And so I was just holding it in, man. And it would erupt out and be directed at her and our kids. So yeah, that 3 years was tough. So it took a lot of courage on her part to ask that question, you know, because for all she knew, I could just, you know, explode right there on the front porch.
You said you thought about throwing yourself in front of a train at one point. Or you know, kind of you conceptualized that. And I just want to make sure I fully understand. What was it that you thought that would accomplish? And what was it you were trying to get away from?
Pain. You know, just you know, that's why I started with that quote from Kaplan. And I didn't read that until recently. It was about a year ago, I guess. But it was just, you know, thinking about, you know, coming up on the 10-year anniversary of this deployment and all the loss. And so you just think about things in a much more complete manner than you had opportunity to at the time, you know? And so when Kaplan, you know, said that hindsight is lazy because it reduces complexity to a counterfeit clarity, that really struck me. But to your question about like, what was it I was trying to stop? It was motivated by looking back and seeing things more clearly than I would have had opportunity to at the time. And so whether it be second guessing how we were doing things, or, you know, why did I put them in an ambush position, you know, that night in that area that this happened, you know, or, you know, with our, the five guys that were killed in August, you know, it was on a company boundary, but, you know, we had just, another company had just built a road in there, and we were tasked with securing part of it. And it was too narrow. And I remember asking for engineer assets to make it wider so we could get some standoff, from, you know, enemy avenues of approach. And I just felt like I didn't fight hard enough for the assets. And in the days afterwards, like the enemy puts an IED in the moon dust that these vehicles create, you know, out there, and five guys are killed, you know, and it could have been prevented. So like for a long time, I struggled with not fighting harder for the assets we needed to prevent that. And so standing, you know, waiting on the train here in DC, like, and just struggling with not only what I had done to my family, but also the feeling of responsibility for that. Like, it's like, you know, it's easier to just step out and move on. And, you know, I mean, thank God that, like, I have a good wife, and I knew that I would be taking a bad situation and making it worse for her, you know, in order to escape the pain I put her through. I was going to put her through more.
Sorry, I'm laughing at that.
No, you're right. It was a, like, look, man, I get it. I get why people feel that desperate. You know, yeah. It hurts. It's oftentimes hard to sleep. You know, it's hard to eat. It's hard to do anything still. No, not as much. I mean, every now and then, usually around anniversaries of incidents. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes, man, just so I have a very keen sense of smell. And so that triggers probably more than anything. Like I can smell something that smelled familiar and, mm-hmm. you know, and honestly, man, there was so much violence, like copper and iron, smelling that, like that triggers, you know, images of, you know, death and destruction more than anything. Cause that's what I remember is the copper and iron smell from our casualties, civilian casualties or the enemy casualties.
You're saying copper and iron, like burning flesh or something like that?
Yeah. Blood. I mean, that's exactly right.
Blood. Okay.
The blood and then, you know, burning flesh. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not pretty. You know, there's unless even dying in your sleep is not super dignified. You know, I think we want to romanticize it and think that's the way I want to go. But for the people who find you, it's awful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, like it's awful. And so, you know, like those were the things, man, you know, that, and the irony is sitting there waiting for the train as they're slowing down, it stirs up all the metal on metal, you know, with the rails. And I think that's probably part of it. I mean, I don't know. I never went and saw anybody about it in particularly, but that could have been a good, you know, triggers this as though the metal on metal smell was mm-hmm. just bringing those things up. And I wasn't necessarily aware of it, but yeah, to answer your question, Mike, it was pain, man, pain of what I caused, pain of what decisions I could have made, you know? And again, I just had to take a step back and understand it that I, based on the information I had at the time, I did everything I could do. So.
Right. Would guilt be another? Is guilt an accurate descriptor as well? Yeah,
I think that's
what it sounds like to me.
I think so. Mm. And, I mean, you're responsible for all of it. You know, you're responsible for the good and the bad.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, I mean, dude, I it was a violent place, you know, and I think part of it is frustration. You know, you guys have both experienced issues with higher headquarters and people who are well-meaning and they're seeing different things than you are, but you know, there's a level of trust that I think is not necessarily fully realized, you know, at higher echelons of the Army. And I'm talking like brigade and above, you know, where they have a responsibility that's greater than ours, but they also have a responsibility to trust us and that we're not going to make stuff up. And, you know, so it was incredibly frustrating sometimes to need those resources and not get them, especially, you know, with the way things had gone up till then. And, so, you know, the guilt of not fighting harder, as I said earlier, like I felt like I could have fought harder for it and maybe I could, maybe I couldn't. It's not like I didn't ask, but, you know, so I think guilt is a good descriptor, Mike.
I try to say this to our guests who's feeling this way, like, you know, you did all that you could, and I think there's nothing else you could have done, and you did all that you could, and that those things happened, and it's while. You know, technically, you know, everyone said, hey, CO, this is your responsibility. Pat has said this before, like you could not control every single thing going on in Afghanistan in that territory. Like,
that's right.
You know, the enemy gets a vote. The staff above you gets a vote. And that responsibility is distributed among everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, you're absolutely right, Mike. You know, I appreciate, you know, you guys' insight and, you know, one of the things that I've come to realize is that I tend to put as I look back, right? Because the more the more costly the decision, the more critical you look back on it, right?
Sure.
And so, and in that, right, our hindsight bias is painful, because you're like, oh, I have all the information now, and boy, that was a dumb decision. But at the time, you might have had 2% of the available information at best.
Exactly right. Yeah.
And so, like, I think to your point, you know, that it is human nature to look at it and see it that way. But it takes opportunities like this to talk with others to really think through it rightly and in a balanced way, and acknowledge that, yeah, while you're responsible for the decision, you're not responsible for everything that led up to it, and then all the actions of everyone else that, but it still doesn't change, you know, that you're going to take responsibility for what you did, and the outcome was, you know, good or bad. And,
and the difficult part is our outcomes in these experiences are, gravely consequential, you know,
right.
On a day-to-day basis, nowadays, I don't make any decisions that have that big of ramifications, right? You know?
Yeah.
And that probably goes back to what we were talking about earlier, too, is like, did I feel like the biggest events of my life are behind me? Because nowadays, I don't make those kind of decisions.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Something, you know, that has been really helpful for me in recent weeks and in preparing to talk with you guys today was reading Sebastian Younger's Tribe.
Mm-hmm. I love that book.
And, you know, while that guy wasn't a soldier, you know, he spent so much time with soldiers in some pretty awful places, both U.S. soldiers and, you know, soldiers in Kosovo and Bosnia, you know, in the 90s. I mean, he's seen a lot of death and killing, and just been a really engaged observer of, you know, combat units. And so that book was really helpful in the sense of understanding, like, some of my own challenges and the challenges that we face in coming home,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so, like, I struggle with, you know, wanting to go back still.
Mm-hmm.
It was a simple, productive, purposeful time. And, you know, I can understand, you know, why folks miss it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody who hasn't experienced it can understand that. I think they might be able to just say, you know, okay, or whatever. But I just wonder sometimes if, you know, sharing that would make friends or family, you know, like, would hurt them.
Yeah.
You know, and feel like somehow you're driving them to that, when that's not really, it's mm-hmm. not the case at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They look at it from a totally different perspective. They, you know, they just want you around and want you close and safe and, mm-hmm. because they like you and they like being around you.
Supposedly like yeah, you.
Supposedly. That's right.
I had one more thing to talk about.
Sure.
And so something you said that I never heard before, but it makes so much sense. And I'm wondering, is this like a slogan or something, or does it need to be, is, you know, living instead of dying for your country, living for your country. Okay. Yeah. Did you hear that somewhere, or did you come up
so
yourself?
No, dude, it's a conglomerate of a lot of things. One was a book about some Air Force PJs, you know, and it was called That Others May Live. And there's a tremendous story in there where these guys are training, and I think it was K2. I can't remember exactly which peak it was, but, you know, Those guys don't train like the rest of us, you know. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of mountaineering and a lot of swimming, because, you know, planes crash in the mountains and they crash in the water. And so, anyway, there's this story where they're training on what I remember, I think it's K2, and so some other climbers tell them about this South Korean climber who's, you know, dying from exposure up the further up the mountain. And they're at like 14 or 15,000 feet at this point. And so it's, if you guys know anything about mountain climbing, you have to climatize as you get higher, right? So you can't just keep going up and, you know, you got to stop and wait a few days and then keep climbing. And so they're at a base camp, you know, trying to climatize, and a group of them start climbing, and they get to this guy, and then they have to lower him down. And the guy that's escorting him, you know, to be lowered down to make sure he doesn't get stuck on a rock, has climbed up, is now climbing down. And, you know, the guys at the top are letting him down on ropes. So anyway, he gets, get him down. They get him to a place where a helicopter can come in, and they medevac this guy off the mountain. Well, then the PJs are going to continue their training. So the guy that has gone up and gone down is now going to go back up again. And, you know, as his friends are telling this story, they recall how he was just physically, he was done. Like his body was just starting to shut down. He was moving slower and slower. And he's the lead climber. And as they're watching him, they realize like the dude is going to, like, he's going to hurt himself. And so there's some conversation between them that says, hey man, you know, how are we going to tell him that he's not going to make it? And one of the guys says, let me handle it. And so he scurries up to, you know, the front and just leans over to him and whispers in his ear. And then the guy immediately turns around and starts walking down. And so he hit the guy that just climbed up to tell him, you know, to talk to him, follows him down. And the other guys asked him, they're like, what did you say to him? And he said, I told him I couldn't make it. And so that's, I mean, even now, like that story, just like that encapsulates the title of that book, you know, that Others May Live. Like that guy went up there and said he couldn't make it. And his buddy didn't even hesitate to turn around. Right. Like he didn't tell him, hey, man, you're not going to make it. So, you know, they said that, like, what you get in that story is both of them sacrificing for the benefit of others, you know? And so, like, they had not only the willingness to die for one another, you know, but what that showed me was like learning to live for each other is beneficial. And I think it's something that Mike should be a slogan. And I think
that's a great takeaway message.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing your journey through the military and afterwards. I know this was probably not the easiest thing to do. And I really appreciate your trust and your courage to like, to sit down and think through these things and to share them with us today. And, you know, I hope that talking to us about these things has helped you in some small way. And, you know, we're, you know, I'm just honored to have you on here today.
Yeah, I agree with Mike. I really appreciate you opening up too and sharing some of those more personal things, because I think that's really what helps others, is to realize that you're not the only one going through this, and other people have had similar thoughts and ideas and feelings, and by having the courage to share that, I think hopefully that reaches some other people as well. So thank you very much.
Yeah. Just as we're saying this, like, I'm thinking like how many other veterans are standing on that train platform.
Right.
Probably, yeah. That was
probably a lot.
Yeah. I really appreciate you guys having me on. I appreciate the opportunity to think through these things, and what it's done is given me, encouragement, like I said earlier, you know, to be more open with both my wife and some of my friends, because some of the hesitancy is you don't want to be a burden, you know, you don't want to dump this baggage on them and be like, all right, thanks. It's very cathartic. I'll see you later. And then now they got to work through your trauma. And,
right.
But I don't think they see it like that.
Yeah.
No. You know? And so, you know, this is a great jumping off point for me to then go back and be willing to share more with them, you know. So I really appreciate this opportunity, both in our conversations, you know, leading up to this, and then, you know, our conversation today. So again, thank you. And it's been a real privilege to share this, you know, because the fact of the matter is there's a lot of great Americans out there doing great things for our country. And though we didn't identify them by name today, you know, their stories are real, and, you know, they can help the veteran community cope with the things that they've experienced.
Well said. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hi there. This is Mike. This episode, we decided to include a bonus segment. Our storyteller gave us a lot of great detail about his time in Afghanistan. And while we trimmed it for time from the main episode, we thought people would really enjoy hearing it. So if you're interested in hearing more about what it was like on the ground in Afghanistan, keep listening. Thanks.
And so when we arrived, the terrain was restrictive and dangerous. In fact, the whole area was a minefield. And as we patrolled the grape and poppy fields between the villages, the enemy would use small arms fire to walk us into dismounted IEDs that were really attriting the platoons. The platoons were just taking a beating, that they couldn't maintain that pace. And I knew that the persistent patrolling was not going to give us the freedom of movement we needed. And, you know, I began talking with my battalion commander about a change of strategy. And we both understood how the intensity of the combat on our soldiers and what they were enduring could impact them. So convincing him to change what we were doing and how we were doing it, and to, you know, essentially saturate the villages with U.S. and Afghan forces, and establishing a series of mutually supporting strong points was actually an easy endeavor. And so I was really fortunate to have, you know, a commander who understood, you know, the situation both there and previous precedents that we had seen firsthand in areas that we were both familiar with. And so as we were developing our plan, one of the most beloved soldiers in the company was killed by an IED while moving into an overnight ambush position. And, you know, the company responded immediately to establish medevac, to get our wounded out of there, and to secure the area that would allow EOD to interrogate the IED site. And as we went through, you know, our priorities of work for security, I called the battalion commander on the radio, and I told him that we were staying out, and that I would be initiating our plan to occupy strong points in the village near where he was killed, and that, you know, the previous plan that we were establishing was gonna, you know, take a back seat. We were just gonna stay out there. And so from that point forward, the majority of the company would occupy squad to platoon size outposts jointly with our Afghan partners for the remainder of the deployment. And it was hard living. I mean, it was mud huts and thatched roofs, and, you know, everything was covered in dirt. Soldiers were covered in dirt. Equipment was covered in dirt. Food was covered in dirt. I mean, it was pretty squalid living. But the change in tactics really flipped the script on the Taliban. And as we were now in the villages to stay, they were no longer able to deny us the freedom of movement we needed within the village. And though they did adjust their tactics, man, and they moved from, you know, harassing small arms fire that was steering us into IEDs and began targeting us with recoilless rifle fire. In fact, you know, we lost another soldier and a handful of wounded, including our company first sergeant in a recoilless rifle ambush in a sister company's AOR, you know, and that became really where the enemy would attack us is along those seams and gaps between companies. And, you know, in spite of the losses, the company continued to respond with resiliency and professionalism, just as, you know, you would expect them to. But, you know, the pace was still, you know, crushing for all of us. And, you know, we continued to patrol from our strong points and would ultimately expand our footprint from village to village. And as we did, it set the conditions for, you know, one of the more influential tribal leaders in the area to come forward with other locals to begin helping secure the area and allow us to establish a positive relationship with the Afghan villagers. And our success led to more success. And over the summer, the enemy's frustration level only increased as they began now firing into the villages where we resided alongside the Afghans. And, you know, that act by the Taliban only further cemented our relationship with the villagers, who were getting to see firsthand that we brought goodness and normalcy behind us as security improved, whether that was, you know, hard-packed roads or establishing police and police presence and as well as economic opportunities, you know, through markets and different things like that. But, you know, as the fighting season continued, we would press the enemy and clear more time and space for the locals to assert themselves in the process and further improve security in the area. But, you know, it was rapidly going from kinetic operations and rapidly transitioning into, you know, more traditional counterinsurgency type operations where we were having to do projects or at least plan for projects, lots of, you know, non-lethal engagements. But the enemy presence was still strong enough that it was not uncommon for us to go from, you know, shooting, you know, some, you know, team or squad size element of Taliban in the fields to, you know, moving humanitarian assistance, you know, seconds later in the village. And so soldiers were up and down. I was up and down as far as just the personal stress that everybody was under. And, you know, we were having so much success that the locals, you know, responded to the improved security by turning over information about caches or IEDs and even expelling, you know, Taliban fighters from the area themselves. And, you know, the success came in such a short period that a number of defense think tanks like the Institute for the Study of War and the Center for New American Security began rotating through to see not only what the company was doing, but what the battalion and brigade was doing and why it was working. You know, and some of those were better interactions than others. You know, these were the folks that were influencing policy at the highest levels. And, you know, it was really interesting, the questions that they would ask. And some of them were great questions and others were almost scripted. You know, in fact, you know, one that stands with me the most is, from, you know, an analyst from CNAS, you know, and he came in and asked me when we were going to start a school. And so that was at a time when, you know, three cups of tea was still kind of the preeminent document for, you know, how to win the local populace over. And I remember telling him, you know, like, hey, man, this is not Field of Dreams. Or I asked him, rather, if he saw any kids, and he was just like, what? And I said, look, man, I said, this is not Field of Dreams. If we build a school, it's not like they're going to suddenly come out of the poppy and marijuana fields to learn to read. Like, we've got to have enough security to get the populace to come back before we could even do anything like that. And so, you know, those kind of interactions only added to some of the frustration we felt like at the national level that people weren't quite understanding what was going on for us, even though they were coming through. But as both of you guys know from your own experiences, you know, there are highs and lows throughout a deployment. And, you know, we had one more real emotional low that late that summer that we would have to overcome. And in the midst of all the success we were experiencing, we lost five soldiers in a catastrophic IED strike on an up-armored vehicle, just again right along another boundary with one of our sister companies. And this loss, you know, was near crushing. It ended up, you know, bringing our KIA as a company, you know, to right around seven, and then you know, another 30 plus wounded for the company at that point. And so it really tested everybody's resolve, and the NCO, the soldiers, NCOs and officers of the company would come together again in the days to come for two major battalion operations that would finally push the Taliban out of the AO and accomplish our mission of clearing the remaining territory that we had taken over. You know, that just further improved our relationship with the locals and allowed us to balance fighting the enemy with treating the locals with respect. And in a lot of cases, you know, real mercy. You know, they were probably some of the most impoverished people I've ever seen. You know, and sometimes, like I said, you know, that change from fighting to, you know, normal conversations could happen within minutes. You know, but because we lived in such close proximity with the villagers, we were constantly in a position to learn about them and what they valued, and would have opportunity to do things that we never would have expected. And, you know, as I said, we would go from these intense firefights and clearance operations with, you know, mortars and engineers and reducing obstacles. I mean, all the kind of combined arms stuff that we all learned at the infantry officer course. And then we ended up hosting a wrestling tournament at the request of our villagers, who just in a conversation, I asked them, you know, what would you like to do that you haven't been able to do in the last 20 years? And, you know, because we had built the relationship that we had with them, they said they wanted to have a wrestling tournament. And so, you know, we had to spend the next couple of weeks just learning what they really needed. And so, yeah, we ended up hosting a wrestling tournament in one of the villages. And, you know, one of the great things about soldiers is that they all have skills that you would never necessarily know about until you start asking. And so we had guys that had done auto body work. And so we were able to do custom paint on a couple motorcycles that we seized from the Taliban. And so we tuned them up and we put custom paint on these motorcycles and gave them away to the top two finishers. And so it was pretty awesome. Just the level of success that we had, given the cost, you know, it was really alleviated a lot of stress, you know, to be able to do that. In fact, one of the soldiers participated and got his butt kicked, which was kind of funny because he was a big dude and a college wrestler, and I mean, he took a shellacking, but you know, it was good, and it was an opportunity for us to deal with stress in a different way.
Thanks for listening to What We Brought Home. If you've enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, please subscribe or follow us wherever you find your podcasts. Like we said at the top of the show, if what you've heard here reminds you of one of your own experiences and you want to tell your story, let us know. We're always looking to talk to fellow veterans. All stories are shared anonymously. Go ahead and visit our website, whatwebrought home.com, to learn more. Thanks again for listening.